Now, on tonight's broadcast, we're going to begin with a single article which was sent to me by a listener, a very chilling article. Then we're going to have the main body of the broadcast. During the program last week, we talked about a number of curious deaths, obvious political murders, and strange disappearances. We are going to continue in that regard, in that vein, for most of the broadcast this evening. So, again, I'm going to begin by reading a fascinating yet terrifying article sent to us by a listener. Excuse me. This is from Eco News. That's the newsletter of the North Coast Environmental Center. Once again, Eco News, newsletter of the North Coast Environmental Center. That's in Arcata, California, volume 18, number 9. This is from October of 1988. Many members of the listening audience, I suspect, regard the subjects discussed on the broadcast, perhaps, as being something distant or remote from their individual lives. Listeners who have been in this area for quite some time will remember in 1981 and 1982, the Santa Clara Valley, the East Bay, or parts of it, and much of the Santa Cruz area was sprayed with paramalathion. And perhaps more interestingly, that bug spray was being sprayed by an organization called Evergreen Helicopter. Now, Evergreen Helicopter is part of Evergreen Aviation, which consists almost entirely of Intermountain Aviation, a CIA Air proprietary, much the same as Southern Air Transport and Air America, which assumed a lot of attention during the Iran-Contra scandal, which continues to boil up to this day, although most people apparently are not paying that much attention, at least if we can believe what the media are telling us. Well, the interesting thing is, again, for those of you who were sitting while those helicopters sprayed paramalathion or whatever it was, should bear in mind that in all probability they were being sprayed by the CIA. We touched on that last week. Interestingly enough, the Evergreen Helicopters was the high bidder on that contract. One wonders just how it is that the high bidder got the contract. Usually that is not the case. But again, in all probability, for those people who view CIA covert operations as something that happens in El Salvador or Guatemala or the Middle East or someplace else, for those people who don't think that CIA misdeeds are ever going to affect them, well, just think about those helicopters and think about what they may have been spraying and think about what might be happening to you in a few years. Because in the past, we know that the American people have been used for experimentation. There's a recently concluded case in which a number of Canadian citizens were experimented upon by the CIA in connection with the MK-Ultra mind control program. A professor down here at Stanford had his father badly messed up as a result of these experiments. And again, the point being here that what goes around comes around, as I say on this program, and when you're hearing about the CIA, you are not necessarily hearing about something that's a long way away. Again, this article comes from Eco News, newsletter of the North Coast Environmental Center. It's from October 1988, volume 18, number 9. This is an article by Tim McKay, M-C, capital K-A-Y, Forest Service, tied to CIA. In today's San Jose Mercury News, today being October 30th of 1988, there is a story beginning on the front page concerning veteran ex-intelligencers who move into some of the high-tech, security-connected companies in the Santa Clara Valley, the much-ballyhooed Silicon Valley. In a way, touches directly on this particular article because the CIA doesn't just operate abroad, and the whole concept of an ex-CIA agent is a very dubious one, as the Iran-Contra scandal has made quite clear to a number of people. The CIA and ex-unquote CIA people do move into civilian life with terrifying regularity and perhaps devastating results. It is not something, again, which operates abroad and which is remote from your life. It is something which affects all of us. Again, the Forest Service tied to the CIA by Tim McKay. Research credit again to a listener. A lengthy 9-part series in the Oregonian newspaper this summer, interrupting, that's the Portland Oregonian, details the links connecting Evergreen Helicopters of Oregon, the Forest Service, and the super-secret Central Intelligence Agency. Veterans of efforts to stop Forest Service aerial spraying of herbicides are familiar with Evergreen, which made $317 million last year because it often sprayed the weed killers. The newspaper's special report uncovered the firm's ties to the CIA based on a network of good old boys, unquote, scattered throughout the government and other aviation companies. The rapid growth of Evergreen was triggered by its acquisition of Intermountain Aviation, a wholly owned CIA company, as well as Johnson Flying Service of Missoula, Montana, a, quote, virtual branch of the U.S. Forest Service that for years secretly had helped the CIA recruit paramilitary personnel, unquote. Investigative reporters James Long and Lauren Cowan, C-O-W-E-N, found extensive links between Intermountain and Johnson, including employees that worked for both organizations part-time. The acquisitions left Evergreen with a coveted airline license, a 2,200-acre former Air Force base in Arizona, and a pipeline to extensive government contracts. Evergreen keeps a specially fitted Boeing 727 on standby for the Defense Department for a tidy $10,000 per day. A better deal is through the U.S. Postal Service, which provides almost $100 million per year for flying express mail, even though five of six other bidders offered cheaper contracts. Former U.S. Postmaster General William Bolger serves on the Evergreen Board of Directors. Let me read those last couple of sentences again. A better deal is through the U.S. Postal Service, which provides almost $100 million per year for flying express mail, even though five of six other bidders offered cheaper contracts. Former U.S. Postmaster General William Bolger serves on the Evergreen Board of Directors. Other contracts are with the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the airline has a long history of contracts with the Forest Service. The series outlined tie-ups between the CIA and the Forest Service going back as early as 1959, when the logging agency was recruiting among its smoke jumpers for missions deep into Laos. Earl Cooley, C-O-O-L-E-Y, who ran the agency's smoke jumper base in Montana for 13 years, remembers that of almost 200 on their active roster, quote, "We trained about a fourth of these guys for the CIA," unquote. Cooley also found it odd that the Forest Service even paid for the security checks for jumpers wanting to join the CIA, quote, "It cost us $400 apiece to get clearances for those jobs, and it sure raised hell with our budget," unquote. The Forest Service apparently did extensive research and development with parachutes to enable operatives and supplies to be dropped into tighter and tighter places, skills necessary for smoke jumpers who were routinely transferred to the CIA and the military. Another smoke jumper base leader, Leonard Kraut, K-R-O-U-T, recalled that in 1959 through 60, the CIA took 8 to 10 of his best people. Not all of those recruited for clandestine service returned, and the CIA routinely made up fictitious stories about their demise. The newspaper said John Merriman, M-E-R-R-I-M-A-N, left Johnson Flying Service for the CIA and then died under suspicious circumstances in Africa. But the agency insisted that he had died in a car wreck. Evergreen founder Del Smith's personal worth is estimated to be close to $150 million. His companies collectively control almost 200 aircraft of all descriptions, and these are bought, sold, and traded with such regularity that it comprises another of Evergreen's lucrative elements. The articles are available for perusal at area libraries, including the NEC. So again, the CIA is not something that operates at a great distance from you. And beyond that, oh, NEC, by the way, is North Coast Environmental Center. And again, bear in mind one of the articles last week concerning a California Agriculture Department official who was killed in a car wreck. And he was the state liaison man with the MedFly spraying program, which used Evergreen helicopters, even though they were the highest bidder on the contract. Worth noting here, perhaps by way of transition to the main bulk of the broadcast this evening, that this John Merriman left Johnson Flying Service for the CIA and then died under suspicious circumstances in Africa, but the agency insisted that he had died in a car wreck. That, in a nutshell, is going to be the focus, that type of incident, of the duration of the broadcast. And again, actually, we might as well include the article from the North Coast Environmental Center, Eco News, in the archive program because it is obviously quite relevant. Again, we're going to continue with suspicious deaths, timely deaths, obvious political murders and disappearances right here in the U.S. of A. Those listeners who heard the phone-in session last week will recall a somewhat contentious call that I had with one of our listeners, and he certainly was a well-intentioned individual, and I did not mean to personally berate him or insult him or perhaps give him pain, but I disagree very strongly with the outmoded method of political activism that so many progressive people seem to use. This individual was interested in drumming up support for a street demonstration against Adolfo Calero. Now, I certainly disagree with America's policy in Central America and its support of the contra-terrorist mercenaries in particular. However, the fact of the matter is, 400 people demonstrating in the street, Generally doesn't get much press and certainly has not been overly effective in stopping America's Central American policy. 400 people calling up, say, a KGO radio station or another phone-in talk show can be very, very effective and cover a much, much larger area. I also think it's in a way tragic that progressive political activists seem far more concerned, at least to outward appearances, with political disappearances, desaparecidos, in Latin America. Certainly it has been going on for, say, the practice of disappearing, i.e. murdering, under clandestine circumstances, members of the political opposition. That has been standard operating procedure among the CIA-supported Latin American dictatorships for a good long time. Tragically, regrettably, that sort of thing is now going on in the United States. Unfortunately, and even more tragically, that practice appears to be escaping the notice of a large percentage of the progressive political community. And by way of helping perhaps to focus that notice, we are going to continue this evening with the Hit Parade. First death on our lineup for this evening comes from the New York Times of May 30th, 1984. This is an obituary of Robert B. Beecher, B-O-E-T-T-C-H-E-R. Robert B. Beecher, who was staff director of a congressional investigation of South Korean influence peddling in Washington in the 1970s, died Thursday in a fall from the roof of an apartment building in Central Park West where he lived. He was 44 years old. From 1971 until 1979, Mr. Beecher directed the staff of the House Subcommittee on International Organizations. In that capacity, he was in charge, under Representative Donald Fraser, of gathering evidence of a scandal in which Tongsun Park, a South Korean millionaire businessman, and others were accused of unlawfully seeking to influence American political figures in providing military and economic aid to Seoul, South Korea. Well, the organization, the international organization underlying, of course, the Koreagate scandal and Tongsun Park was none other than Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. Now, the Unification Church, as we looked at in considerable detail in Radio Free America number 7, which used Mr. Beecher's book called Gifts of Deceit, copyrighted in 1980, the Unification Church is basically a front for South Korean intelligence, and beyond that, it is a massive worldwide organization of explicitly fascist nature. The Unification Church wields tremendous influence not only in American foreign policy through such organizations as CAUSA, but also it wields a tremendous influence on the contemporary American far right. The Unification Church employs to a considerable extent Koreans of an explicitly fascist political orientation whose political geniture goes back to their work for the Imperial Japanese National Security Establishment during World War II, when Korea was a Japanese colony and some Korean males were drafted or willingly went to fight on behalf of fascist Imperial Japan. And again, those who tend to oppose organizations like the Unification Church, a key element of the World Anti-Communist League, often wind up the way the late, unfortunate Mr. Robert Beecher wound up. Can't win them all. Rest in peace, Robert Beecher. A group of people who have been experiencing considerable hardships are union activists in the United States. In particular, the International Longshoremen's Workers Union had a series of unfortunate killings that took place in their midst in 1982. This from the San Francisco Examiner, February 24th of 1982. This is an article by Paul Shinoff, the Examiner labor writer. It's called A Second Look. Assassination of ILWU aide remains a scary puzzle. Dateline Oakland. More than a month after the fatal shooting of controversial labor leader Roberto Flatte, some of his supporters continue to believe that the killing was the work of a vengeful union splinter group that has marked others for assassination. A lot of people are scared. They are afraid to talk, said one member. There are people out there carrying guns. Officials of Flotte's union, the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, refused to discuss the killing beyond their comments in a single terse press statement. Police have no specific suspects nor a clear motive in the May 1st attack on Flotte 47, which left him mortally wounded in the parking lot of the union's Oakland office at 99 Hegenberger Road. Flotte, business agent for ILWU Local 6, died April 13th at Oak Knoll Hospital without regaining consciousness. It remains a puzzle, said Oakland homicide detective Jerry Metzger. The attack came almost a year after a May 1981 shooting outside the union's San Francisco office. Member Philip Freitas, described as a Flotte bodyguard, was killed. The investigation continues to wade through conflicting tales that paint Flotte either as a political saint or a sinner. a courageous leader who attempted to forge multiracial unity within the Union, or a victim of self-enrichment and political double-dealing. I have heard everything implicating gangsters to the FBI to the CIA. You can take any one of them, said Local 6 member Joe Ecker, E-C-K-E-R 37, who was with Flotte the night of the attack and was wounded in the neck as he chased one of the assailants. Flotte's supporters within the 8,000-member union say he was the victim of a racial and political vendetta linked, quote, to Mexican nationalists, unquote, implicated in the San Francisco shooting. I would add here, I don't know what the bottom line is here with regard to the killings in this union. Nationalist here, for what it's worth, and perhaps it's apocryphal under the circumstances, nationalist is often an American reactionary apologist for the term fascist. And as we looked at in our work on the World Anti-Communist League, there are a lot of American fascists associated with the Los Tecos branch of the World Anti-Communist League in Guadalajara. Continuing. But one former union member said to be a member of that group denied any knowledge of a plot against Flotte. Metzger said his office has not ruled out the possibility that the killing stemmed from a bungled robbery attempt in the dark parking lot. The attack has troubled the union, now negotiating a new master warehouse agreement covering 4,000 members. The current agreement with Ford with 200 employers expires June 1st. We do not want anything to distract from that negotiation. For that reason, we have nothing to say about the recent assassination, except we opposed violence of any kind, said Local 6 President Keith Eichmann. And again, the exact culprits here in the Flotte shooting remain to be determined. It should be noted, however, that as the article that we're about to examine indicates, the terrible violence with regard to the ILWU did not end there. This from the Oakland Tribune East Bay Today from Tuesday, May 25th of 1982, roughly 3 months after the article I just read. This is by Martin Halstuck, H-A-L-S-T-U-K, and Angel Fernandez of the Tribune. Headline, Jobless Vet Charged in Slaying of Union Activist. Victoria Mercado, a 31-year-old woman who was shot and killed in Hayward Sunday, was a former companion of black activist Angela Davis and friend of slain labor leader Roberto Flotte. In custody for the murder and charged with murdering Mercado and attempting to murder her roommate is a man described by friends as a disillusioned ex-paratrooper who was discharged in February and was angry and frustrated over not being able to find a job. Police at first were probing any possible link between Mercado's slaying and the deaths of two officials of International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, but discounted it because of the circumstances of Mercado's killing and the background of the suspected slayer, Eugene Delgado, 34, of Hayward. Flotte, who died in April from gunshot wounds, was a business agent for Local 6 of the Longshoremen's Union, the same union in which Mercado was active. Another member of the strife-torn local, Philip Freitas of South San Francisco, was shot to death May 28 of last year. After Flotte's death, Mercado said she believed Flotte was shot because he resisted pressure to show favoritism in assigning jobs. Mercado and her roommate, Patricia Manis, 31, were shot while at a home on Ralston Court in an unincorporated area just outside Hayward. Mercado was shot in the head and died en route to the hospital. Manis was still in serious condition at the Castro Valley Eden Hospital's intensive care unit with bullet wounds to her head and throat. Again, we cannot draw any conclusions from this, but it's interesting that the woman here, skipping down a little bit more about the late Victoria Mercado. Mercado was born in Salinas and reared in Watsonville and came to the Bay Area to attend San Francisco State in 1969, said her mother Esther Blend, B-L-E-N-D. In 1975, Mercado and Davis, who wrote an acknowledgement to Mercado in Davis's written recent book, Women, Race, and Class, filed a joint suit against then Alameda County Sheriff Frank I. Madigan, Highland Hospital, and the City of Oakland for $150,000, charging harassment and false imprisonment after a dispute between the women and a sheriff's deputy. Speaking of her daughter on Monday, Blend said, quote, she never harmed anyone in her life. I can't comprehend what happened. Well, again, we can't draw any conclusions, but an awful lot of people around Angela Davis, one way or another, have died under strange circumstances. In Radio Free America program number 23, we took an extended look at the terror that obtained in California under then-Governor Ronald Reagan and the connections between that terror and some of the assassinations of black political activists and provocations and the U.S. National Security Establishment operating in conjunction with certain local police departments or elements thereof. And that's also interesting that this fellow who apparently, at least according to the article here, was the lead suspect in the killing of Victoria Mercado was an ex-paratrooper. Again, in Radio Free America programs 5, 6, and 7, we took a look at the mind control programs undertaken by the CIA and the military aimed at developing, and I should say they were very successful programs, mind control assassins to be utilized on command. Again, there is a great deal of corruption in various unions. One wonders whether corruption was all that was bedeviling people in and around the ILWU. But I don't think we'll find out any more about it at this juncture. Speaking of unions and corruption and murder, or possible murder, and political shenanigans, this from the New York Times of Wednesday, July 16th of 1986. An AP story datelined Cleveland headlined, Stephen Ola of Justice Department, OLAH, led inquiry into Teamsters. Stephen R. Ola, a Justice Department official who led the Cleveland investigation of Jackie Presser, president of the Teamsters Union, died Sunday. He was 41 years old. Mr. Ola was pronounced dead at suburban Euclid General Hospital, where he had been taken after complaining of chest pains at a party. He died, apparently of a heart attack, family members said. Dr. Robert Challener, Challener, deputy Cuyahoga County coroner, said that the cause of death was under investigation, but there were indications of a history of heart disease. He would not be more specific. Mr. Ola led the investigation of Mr. Presser and two other union officials who were indicted on May on charges of padding the payroll of a local of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. All three have pleaded not guilty. A trial date has yet to be set. Well, again, the history of shenanigans vis-a-vis the Teamsters Union is long and well documented. Beyond that, the Teamsters Union has massive and apparently ongoing connections to organized crime. And the late Jackie Presser, for he died of a brain tumor not too long ago, had also served, among other things, as an informer for the FBI. The connections of Teamster-related organized crime elements to, among other things, the U.S. National Security Establishment and also the assassination of President John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were covered not only in the Guns of November programs, but also in Radio Free America number 9 about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. It's interesting to note that that particular article was from July 16th of 1986. Jackie Presser died during the course of the last year. Just about a week later, this on Wednesday, July, in fact, exactly a week later, on Wednesday, July 23rd of 1986, we find the following story. Now, bear in mind that Stephen Ola, who headed the investigation into the Teamsters, dropped dead of an apparent heart attack on Wednesday, July 15th. It should be borne in mind that, again, as we've looked at considerable length in the course of our broadcasts, the U.S. National Security Establishment long ago began undertaking devices for giving people heart attacks and cancer. We took a look at that in the archive show, which went in under the examination of the circumstances surrounding Mae Brussels' death. That is available from archives on audio. And it should be noted also that not only are heart attacks, apparent strokes, cancers, one-car automobile accidents, and so forth, a common means of getting rid of somebody when you want to make that death look like an accident rather than a murder, but also there is a saying in the clandestine services, give us the coroner, we'll control the city. Again, give us the coroner, we'll control the city. Bear in mind again, the obit about Stephen Ola was Wednesday, July 16th of 1986. 1 week later, Wednesday, July 23rd of 1986, we find the following story, a UPI story datelined Washington, D.C., headlined, White House denies political payoff to Teamsters. The White House denied today that it had paid off the International Brotherhood of Teamsters for supporting President Reagan by helping the union win an election to represent civilian workers at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Larry Speaks, the White House spokesman, confirmed today that a White House political advisor, Mitchell Daniels, with the backing of the Defense Department, set up a meeting last October between officials of the Teamsters Union and the Army. He said the purpose of the meeting was to discuss the Army contracting work to outside workers instead of having it done by civilian employees at Fort Sill, who were represented by the National Federation of Federal Employees, which the Teamsters Union was competing with to represent the workers. The meeting took place a few days before the vote on union representation, which the National Federation of Federal Employees lost to the Teamsters. The Federation had represented most of the 2,500 civilian workers at Fort Sill for 15 years. Officials of the Federation filed a complaint about the meeting with the Federal Labor Relations Authority, which deals with unions representing federal employees. The authority reported in February that the meeting was an apparent violation of the labor law requiring government neutrality in union representation elections. The complaint is being considered by an administrative law judge. The Teamsters Union, after the meeting, began a publicity campaign among the workers, touting its access to the White House with a flyer headlined, "When we talk for you, the White House listens," unquote. Stephen Kreisberg, director of the Federation of Federal Employees, said the meeting was, quote, a political payoff for the support that the Teamsters have given the White House, unquote. Mr. Speaks said, not so, because we weren't aware we were doing any favors for the Teamsters. Well, I wonder what the late Stephen Ola might have been able to provide concerning what sort of information he might have been able to provide concerning this article. Obviously, we will never know. At this juncture, we won't know anything more from Jackie Presser either, because he died of a brain tumor not too long ago. Obviously, we can't draw any definite conclusions from those two articles, but it certainly is intriguing. And again, I wonder, perhaps had Stephen Ola not died of an apparent heart attack, one wonders what information he might have uncovered concerning Teamster shenanigans and Reagan White House shenanigans at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Rest in peace, Stephen Ola. Another interesting death. From the Oakland Tribune, East Bay Today, from June 4th of 1982. 1982 was a very mortal year, I guess you could say. This is an AP story for Dateline Cincinnati, Ohio. Nuclear inspector's death questioned. A 25-year-old quality control inspector at the Zimmer nuclear plant who was killed in a traffic accident may have witnessed harassment of fellow inspectors at the site, the Cincinnati Inquirer reported Thursday. The inspector, John McCorkle, was killed in a two-car traffic accident Tuesday. The newspaper said in a copyright story that police were checking into reports that McCorkle was involved in a high-speed chase before the accident on Ohio 222. Troopers found a loaded gun in McCorkle's wrecked car, the newspaper said. Two co-workers whose names were not given told the newspaper that McCorkle saw an incident last week in which a bucket of dirty water was dumped on three fellow inspectors. Harassing a nuclear inspector is a felony, and federal regulatory officials are trying to find out who is responsible. Nuclear Regulatory Commission officials said they hadn't questioned McCorkle in connection with the incident, and he wasn't an informer. A spokesman for the Cincinnati Gas and Electric Company, one of three utilities building Zimmer, said there was no reason initially to believe there was anything unusual about McCorkle's accident. Construction at the $1.3 billion plant in Moscow, Ohio, was halted Friday after the water was dumped on inspectors. Workers returned Tuesday after signing statements acknowledging that they were aware that harassing federal inspectors violates federal law. Well, rest in peace, Mr. McCorkle. One wonders if he didn't fear something. One wonders why he was carrying a gun in his car. Apparently, he died after a high-speed chase. Again, we can't draw any conclusions from that, but it'd be interesting to know more. An interesting death, somewhat closer to home, was in the Oakland Tribune of Wednesday, July 3rd of 1985. This is a story by David Alcott of the Tribune. Dateline Berkeley headlined, Kenneth G. Kolstad, C-O-L-S-T-A-D. It's an obituary. A private memorial was held here last night for Kenneth G. Kolstad, an inventor lauded by friends as a visionary genius whose unexplained death in his sleep a week ago is being investigated by coroner's officials. Kolstad, a 38-year-old chemist, was found in bed at his Point Richmond apartment last Wednesday. An autopsy found no obvious cause of death. Contra Costa Coroner's Deputy Dave Dyer said a toxicological study will be completed next week. A tireless intellectual activist in Berkeley's progressive community, he had an imagination so far-reaching that the late Dr. Willard F. Libby, L-I-B-B-Y, a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, invited Kolstad to study with him at UCLA after a chance meeting. Kolstad and his longtime friend, Jamie Huberman, set up a basement prototype in 1972 of what is now Berkeley's Community Memory Project, a system of computer terminals available for free public use at Community Co-op, Whole Earth Access, and La Peña Restaurant. And again, the fact that he was a tireless activist in Berkeley's progressive community, I think, is worth keeping in mind here, especially in light of his unexplained death in his sleep and no apparent cause of death after the autopsy. And again, we might want to bear in mind the phrase, the aphorism from the clandestine services that I cited a few minutes ago, give us the coroner, we'll control the city. Rest in peace, Kenneth G. Kolstad. There has been considerable press over the last several years about the reactionary Vietnamese community in this country, and in particular not only organized crime undertakings by elements of that community, but also reactionary political pressure being directed, often in a very violent manner, against those members of the Vietnamese political community who do not agree with the staunch anti-communist stance of the Vietnamese emigre community, or most of it in this country. Another article from Bloody 1982, this from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, June 8th of 1982. SF murder suspect freed. Murder charges were dismissed yesterday against a Vietnamese restaurant cashier who was accused in the San Francisco shooting death of a controversial Vietnamese communist sympathizer. Dot Van Nguyen, 26, who had been held 9 months in city prison awaiting trial, was freed yesterday because the district attorney's office admitted in Superior Court that a key witness could not identify Dot. Dot was accused of murdering Lam Trong Duong, a 27-year-old social worker who edited a leftist Vietnamese newspaper and had a reputation as a supporter of the communist regime in Hanoi. Lam was shot in the chest at close range in front of his Tenderloin apartment building on the morning of July 21, 1981. He died within minutes. Although police believe the motive for the slaying was personal, two right-wing groups, the Anti-Communist Viets Organization and the Vietnamese Organization for Communist Extermination, sent letters to news organizations claiming responsibility for the murder. This is a remarkable article. Again, I certainly cannot comment in any kind of definitive fashion about the specific guilt or innocence of Dot Van Nguyen, but it would seem that allowing this murder to go unpunished, and I never saw anything else, as the notes on this article indicate, concerning this murder, when two right-wing Vietnamese organizations took credit for the killing, suggests either that the authorities in this country were not overly interested in pursuing the murder of Lam Trong Duong, or perhaps the law enforcement community does not have sufficient Vietnamese membership to adequately enforce these kinds of goings-on within the Vietnamese community. Certainly food for thought and grounds for further research. It is interesting to contemplate the political future of progressive political Americans, given the certainty of some, and I say some, CIA and U.S. National Security Establishment contact with the reactionary Vietnamese community. Bearing in mind the lesson of the anti-Cuban exile community in this country, which has not only conducted a very bloody and criminally stained history in conjunction with the CIA as well as on their own, they've been involved in drug trafficking as well as covert operations. It'll be interesting to contemplate the same kind of a phenomenon vis-a-vis the Vietnamese community. Again, food for thought, grounds for further research. Rest in peace, Dot Van Nguyen. Can't win them all. Another interesting death, perhaps a murder. This from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, June 16th of 1986. Arrest in AIDS death. And again, I never saw the results of the trial here, so I can't say that this fellow was convicted. A man arrested in the strangulation death of a top aide to District of Columbia Mayor Marion Barry was hospitalized 2 weeks ago for a psychiatric evaluation after he barricaded himself inside his house, police say. Kenneth Dion Hubbard, 25, was due to be arraigned today on felony murder charges in Washington, D.C. Superior Court for the murder of Peggy Russell G., 55. G-E-E is her last name. And she was, as it indicates here, Barry's campaign scheduling assistant. District of Columbia Deputy Police Chief Alfonso Gibson said Hubbard was arrested 1:30 a.m. yesterday, about 20 hours after G's body was found by firefighters in her burning house. And again, the murders of political people in this country, and obviously Mayor Marion Barry is a black political leader, they are to be taken due note of. Another interesting death here. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, November 18th of 1987. This is datelined Hamilton, New York. It's a UPI story. It's the obituary of Terrence Desprez, or Desprez. I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. I'm going to pronounce it Desprez. Terrence D-E-S, capital D-E-S, capital P-R-E-S. Terrence Desprez, 47, an award-winning author whose haunting interviews with concentration camp survivors brought him national acclaim, died on Monday at his home in upstate New York, officials said. The cause of his death was not immediately known, but the coroner who examined his body reported that, quote, "it appears to be an accidental death," unquote, said James Leach, spokesman for Colgate University. His loss to the world of American letters will be immense, said Charles Trout, provost and dean of faculty at Colgate University, where Desprez was a professor of English. A noted reviewer, essayist, and college lecturer, Desprez was best known for his book, The Survivor, An Anatomy of Life and of Life in the Death Camps, a collection of interviews with Holocaust survivors published in 1976. President Jimmy Carter appointed Desprez to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council in 1980 in recognition of his work. Well, it's no secret that explicitly Nazi and fascist elements in this country are not only actively pushing the no-Holocaust theory of history, the notion that the Nazi extermination of the Jews either did not happen or was greatly exaggerated, But also, as we've seen in a number of political killings that have taken place in this country, these explicitly Nazi and fascist elements do not hesitate to dispose of their political opponents when they are in a position to do so. As we've looked at, among other places, in The Guns of November, number 4, and in the Aryan Nation series in Radio Free America, numbers 10, 11, 12, and 13, currently being aired on a sister station, KKUP, those same elements also have documented connections to the U.S. national security establishment. Again, for those people who have not seen it, the current motion picture Betrayed by Costa Gavras, a chilling and unnervingly accurate picture of the activities of the Aryan Nation's neo-Nazi network, that picture is currently being shown, and I would strongly encourage everyone listening to this program or subsequently hearing the tape of this program to go see that movie, or perhaps if it's out of the theater circuit, to rent the video cassette if you can. A chilling movie, and something which I think it's a subject which Americans, every right-thinking American, would do well to be aware of. One wonders perhaps just what sort of an accidental death may have been behind the death of 47-year-old Terrence Desprez. Rest in peace, Terrence. Tough luck. Can't win them all. Another interesting death. Friday, November 14th, 1980, in the San Francisco Chronicle, a UPI story, Dateline, New York. This is the obituary of Sam Harris. Sam Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, a prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trial of Hermann Göring and 21 other Nazis, plunged to his death yesterday from his apartment on Manhattan's Upper East Side, police said. He was 68. Police said it was an apparent suicide. Harris's body was found by neighbors in the alleyway of his apartment building at East 75th Street. Harris served on the staff of Robert Jackson, the chief U.S. prosecutor at the dramatic 1946 trial of the leaders of wartime Nazi Germany. Harris, then a captain in the army, presented evidence that the Nazis had stripped Poland and the Soviet Union of food for Germany, letting millions starve. Well, Sam Harris won't starve. He won't be wanting for food, and he certainly won't be needing any. Rest in peace, Sam Harris. Another interesting death, this from the San Jose Mercury News of Monday, August 25th of 1986. This is the obituary of King, Alfred, 33. Alfred King, as it says here, a nephew of Martin Luther King Jr., Friday in Atlanta, of an apparent heart attack. That is, an apparent heart attack at the ripe old age of 33. King collapsed after jogging and was brought to Piedmont Hospital in full cardiac arrest, said a hospital spokesman. He was at least the fourth member of his family to die prematurely. His father, A.D. King, brother of Martin Luther King Jr., drowned at age 38 in July of 1969 in a swimming pool at his Atlanta home. His sister, Esther Darlene King, collapsed after jogging and died in 1976 at age 20. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death in Memphis in April of 1968. And what's not indicated here is that Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother was shot to death shortly after Dr. King himself was shot to death. She had been at the autopsy and had information concerning the placement of the wounds and would have been in a position to testify concerning discrepancies between the official version and what actually happened. And again, one wonders here whether perhaps the death of King, Alfred might have some relationship to the King Alfred Plan, the National Security Establishment contingency plan, supposedly false, but as we've looked at, in all probability true, that basically served, apparently, at least according to Alfonso Chardy of the Miami Herald, in the July 5th, 1987 edition of that paper, as the basis for the Rex 84 martial law plan, which allegedly, at least according to the Christic Institute, would have provided for the internment of roughly a 500,000 Central American refugees and American political activists. This was to have been executed by Patriot Ollie North and Company, at least according to the Sheehan affidavit. Rest in peace, King, Alfred. And again, maybe King, Alfred was a victim of the King Alfred plan. We're now going to take a musical break. I'm going to give myself a chance to rest my voice. Obviously, I need it. And then we're going to come back with some more cheerful news here on One Step Beyond. Good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. We are in the middle of downloading some archival material, actually selected to a considerable extent at random from my files on suspicious deaths, political murders, and strange disappearances right here in the U.S. of A. We've talked at great length on these broadcasts about the Aryan Nations, the neo-Nazi umbrella network, which has documented ties from the national security establishment, and some of whose operatives functioned at low levels in the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy, among other killings. This past spring, we discussed an Aryan Nations, actually a National Vanguard-sponsored initiative which would have mandated, it was a stockholders' motion, which would have mandated the management of AT&T to reverse its policies concerning affirmative action with regard to blacks on the basis that blacks are genetically inferior to whites. That initiative, which was defeated, although another initiative calling for greater participation by minorities in AT&T management was defeated by an even wider margin, that initiative was opposed by the management of AT&T, and the chairman of the board of AT&T died of a quick-acting case of cancer a couple of days before that initiative was defeated. That stockholder's motion was defeated. And again, it was about a month-long case of cancer, and it should be noted that, again, in the archive show concerning the circumstances surrounding Mae Brussels' death, that James E. Olson was a, we noted in the Mae Brussels program that it is possible to give people cancer artificially. In fact, there have actually been a couple of convictions for murder, one in this country and one in Germany, for people who gave people cancer deliberately by putting substances in their food. Following article, research credit goes to the late Mae Brussels. This from the San Jose Mercury News of April 19th of 1988. It's the obituary of James E. Olson, 62, chairman of AT&T, AP Story of New York. James E. Olson, O-L-S-O-N, whose bulldog tenacity led him from manholes in North Dakota to the chairmanship of AT&T, died Monday after a month-long battle with colon cancer. He was 62. His death came after just 1.5 years as leader of American Telephone and Telegraph Company. The powerfully built chief executive had cut costs and shaken the company out of the sense of drift that followed the 1984 breakup of the Bell system. Mr. Olson's deterioration was rapid. The company said the cancer was diagnosed after he became ill with flu on March 18th. He had surgery 7 days later for removal of a tumor in the colon. He returned home on April 1st and had been undergoing chemotherapy as an outpatient since. He died at home in Short Hills, New Jersey. Again, we can't draw any definite conclusions from this, but in light of the fact that he opposed a Nazi-sponsored initiative which would have reversed AT&T's affirmative action program on the basis that blacks are genetically inferior to whites, and in light of the fact that it is, as a matter of record, as we looked at in our program concerning the circumstances surrounding Mae Brussels' death, it is a matter of public record that murder can now be committed by cancer, we have to ask the question concerning the death of James E. Olson, who opposed the National Vanguard Nazi Initiative. Food for thought and grounds for further research. Rest in peace, James Olson. Research credit on the following story goes also to Mae Brussels, the late Mae Brussels. This is the obituary of Travers J. Bell, Jr. This is from the Washington Post of January 28, 1988. Again, the obit of Travers J. Bell, Jr., 46, founder of the only black-owned member firm of the New York Stock Exchange. Bell died January 25th at his home in New York City after an apparent heart attack. He started the Wall Street securities firm of Daniels & Bell in 1971 with $175,000. The company has grown to a net worth of $15 million, specializing in underwriting securities of minority-owned businesses. Again, it is very, very easy to give people a heart attack and to make it appear natural. We don't know whether that's a case with Travers J. Bell, but with groups like the Aryan Nations running amok, it's a question that has to be asked. Rest in peace, Travers J. Bell, Jr. Another death about which I think we have to ask the same question for the same reasons. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, September 20th of 1986. This is a story about the death of Judge Patricia McKinley. Municipal Court Judge Patricia Ann McKinley, Contra Costa County's first black female judge, died of cancer in Richmond Thursday night at the age of 37. Ms. McKinley was named to the Bay Judicial District Bench in 1983. She was one of 15 judges appointed by Governor Jerry Brown on his second-to-last day in office. Born in San Francisco and raised in Richmond, Ms. McKinley had a reputation as an aggressive attorney and an innovative judge. She was one of those exceptional people who cares about doing a good job, said a colleague, Alameda County Superior Court Judge-elect Roderick Duncan. It was clear that she wanted to do things in a different way, in a better way, unquote. A graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, Ms. McKinley served as a human rights officer for the Alameda County Training and Employment Board after graduating from Bolt Hall Law School in 1974. After spending 5 years in private practice in Oakland, Ms. McKinley joined the city attorney's office in Richmond, as a deputy and was promoted to assistant city attorney in 1981. She also served as a board member of the West Contra Costa County Rape Crisis Center, the Shimada Friendship Board, and the Richmond Sister City Program before her appointment to the bench. Judge Patricia McKinley, dead at the age of 37 of cancer. Perhaps natural, perhaps not. We won't find out. So long, Pat. Tough luck.